Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, April 23rd. Breaking news, Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke has announced she's taking a leave of absence after receiving a target letter from the State Attorney General. Construction on the next leg of Skyline into the urban core marked a milestone with the construction of its first column in the downtown route. And we hear from the president of MidPack Institute. His school is at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence and education. He recently took part in a panel on AI literacy. We speak with an ocean expert who makes the case for how the ocean is like the Earth's engine. And we flash back to a local jazz club that was once a hotspot for young musical talent. We bring you to the Cavalier Club. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. There's been an extraordinary development in the probe of the mystery lawmaker who took $35,000 in a paper bag. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo joins us in studio with the very latest. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
Yes, just minutes ago, new development. Share with our listeners what just happened.
Yes, Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke has decided to take a leave of absence without pay for an indefinite period starting immediately. She did acknowledge some of the allegations that have been concerning her regarding bribery charges. She received a target letter from the state attorney general just yesterday. Her lawyer had confirmed that, and she was supposed to be meeting with governor today to discuss the issue. And then just moments ago, she sent out a statement saying that she would be taking this leave of absence without pay.
Yeah, and this was tied to the bribery probe that sent two of our lawmakers to jail.
Yeah, back in 2022, there was the bribery scandal with former House Representative Ty Cullen and Senator Kalani English. In that bribery investigation, where both of them did plead guilty, there was a portion of the filing that said that there was an influential lawmaker who was unidentified that accepted $35,000 in a paper bag in that January 2022 meeting. And that is what has been circulating around Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke, because she did have a meeting with Ty Cullen at that time with a lobbyist where she did not report $5,000 campaign contributions in 2022, although at that time she did report returning them to that particular lobbyist. She denies that she ever took the $35,000 in a paper bag. And, the attorney general, though, has been spending the last 3 months to investigate these claims, reviewing these pages and subpoenaing materials and conducting interviews, and then sent out the target letter yesterday to not just Lieutenant Governor Luke, but also reportedly the lobbyist in question, Toby Solidum. So, when we're looking at what is going to happen next, in the line of succession for Lieutenant Governor, if Lieutenant Governor steps down, the position is first offered to Senate President, then the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and then the Attorney General, who is Ann Lopez, who has already said that she will not take it. In the past, Senate President Ron Cochi has denied the role when asked. And because I think one of the issues when you do accept the role, if it's abdicated, is that you have to usually give up your position. So if Senate President were to take the LG position in her absence, then he would have to leave his position on the Senate. Same thing for the House of Representatives. But after the Attorney General, the next person in line is Director of Budget and Finance, which is Seth Colby. It's not clear if because of a leave of absence, the same rules are required for you to completely abdicate your position or what is going to happen in that situation, but that's the general line of succession. This morning I spoke with former federal public defender Alvy Silver, who has been leading this call to reveal this accused lawmaker who took the $35,000 in the paper bag. And I asked him about what happens now that a target letter has been issued. And he says if there is an indictment, it can take kind of two different forms. It'll either be very broad and not have that much information, or it could be what's called a talking indictment.
It could be a talking indictment where they lay out all the facts and then you do learn a lot. That's really up to the prosecutor how they write the indictment. Most indictments are very narrow and very brief in terms of what information they contain. So that's one thing that we could learn from an indictment. You won't get the investigative reports. You won't learn what really happened. You won't learn who all the witnesses are unless, of course, it ends up in a trial. If there is no indictment, I don't think you're going to learn very much at all, because if no one is charged, then the AG's not going to release information related to their investigation, because there are criminal rules that bind her not to release such information, and there's privacy rules. And so I think in either way, you're not going to get a lot of information out there to the public about what's really going on, unless this all results in a full-blown trial.
And so you heard right there about what may happen and how much information could come out. You know, the Attorney General is still doing her investigation of this matter. And in previous press conferences, she has said that she is going to try to be as transparent as possible. But Ali Silver has been pushing the House to do a public investigation so that more information about what happened could come to light. You know, he sent the House the citizens' petition, which was signed by over, 900 residents. But, the House actually filed that communication yesterday, which effectively kind of squashes the possibility for an investigation by the House. One of the lawmakers, Vice Speaker Linda Ichiyama, spoke on the floor about the petition. But, what she said during that time is that their door is still open to have this discussion about this petition and what could go forward, but they don't want to jeopardize the Attorney General's investigation at this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a crazy turn of events. So much happening just in a couple of days. It'd be interesting then to see what develops over the next 24 hours, who takes over that position.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We have been talking to HBR's Ashley Mazua with the latest on the probe by the state attorney general involving Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke, who has just announced she is taking a leave of absence.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
You know, tonight the public is being invited to learn more about the plans for the Iwile Rail Station as Skyline moves into the urban core. There's been concern about the design as escalators have been eliminated from some of the stations, including Chinatown, as work pushes ahead to construct the downtown area. Hart says the community workshop is not meant to address major design changes to the stations. But that said, there have been some unexpected finds along the construction route. There have been human remains or EV unearthed in the Halekuila area, as well as an undocumented underground fuel tank. But Hart marked a key milestone earlier this month as the first column was poured at the corner of Ala Moana and Fort Street, just by the Aloha Tower Marketplace. We got a chance to talk to Hart CEO Lori Kaikina just after it celebrated the milestone. One column down and about 140 to go.
So that's a huge milestone for us. That's why we wanted to make a big deal out of it. So it's the first. We actually have maybe about 20 shafts that have already been dug, and we've got the foundations in, and then the next step is the columns. And I want to say there's going to be about 140 columns all the way through the city center guideway station. So this is the first of many, and I think the next ones are going to be coming up in the Iwile area. There's going to be decorative ones, just like on the west side at each of the stations. We'll have the decorative columns. So we just wanted to highlight that, okay, it's the start of the next segment, because we've done a lot of work underground where people really can't see the physical accomplishments that are being done. They get definitely frustrated with all of the 1,000 cones out at Dillingham and having to, navigate, that's a better word, thank you. They have to navigate through all of the construction and not being able to turn left. So all of the public speaking I'm doing, I'm reminding everyone, I've said it numerous times that those left turns are never coming back. It's just going to be like the west side that's on Dillingham. There's, of course, the main intersections. Yes, we're going to have the left turns, but you will not be able to turn left out of driveways or left into driveways or the small side streets. There's going to be a medial strip there, so people need to adjust their habits now.
And then what about as you get further into the urban core, you know, along Nimitz and Ala Moana, are the lefts going to disappear there? How does that all work?
No, that should still, I believe, should still be. You're talking about, like yes. I said, the main intersections. Yeah, that should all still be there.
Well, with this first column, I understand it took a heck of a lot of concrete to pour because you had to drill down, or go down pretty deep, right?
We did have to go down pretty deep. I want to say between 30 to 50 feet. And there was so many concrete cement trucks that were coming in and out. And Tudor Perini actually did a pretty good job of trying to keep it smooth. We didn't have too many complaints. The one complaint, and fair, the resident right there, Harbor Court, it was at night, late at night. And so what happens is the casing that is put in, as they start to pull it out, as the cement is being poured in, they pull that casing out and they bang it. It's a metal casing, and they're banging it with metal hammers. And so you can imagine the frustration. Let's say it's 10 o'clock at night, this loud hammering. So we had to try to schedule it as much as we can during the day. But if they're running late, that's what would happen. So we forewarned the residents in the area that, you know, it might be going as late as 8 o'clock. But we really tried to let the community know in advance that, hey, we're running into problems and it's going to be a little bit late. So we're stuck in the middle of two regulatory agencies. We cannot block the road during peak traffic hours, so you need to make sure you bring in the cement trucks without blocking the roads. But then in the evening hours, you have Department of Health with the noise levels that we need to stay below a certain threshold. But we're trying. We're trying to be good partners and good neighbors for the community, but we do need to get the construction done.
Well, you know, I was driving down there recently during the heavy rains that we've had, and there was flooding, you know.
Oh, God. So I'm glad you brought that up. I was extremely disappointed with that incident. All the prior, the two Kona Lows before that, the team did really good. I'm talking about Tudor Perini, and I brag about them quite a bit that they are a very sophisticated contractor. They're BMPs that are put in place. Even one of our board members during the storm, she said, hey, I just passed on Nimitz and not a speck of dirt is coming out of their area. And I said, yeah, they did really good. In this one case, it was a subcontractor. It's still Tudor's responsibility. It was a subcontractor that they didn't have the proper equipment in place, and it did cause that flooding, unfortunately, across the highway, and there was some that went into the harbor. They followed all the proper protocols as far as notifications, letting the Department of Health know, and they cleaned it up quickly within the next couple of hours. But yes, exactly. That incident never should have happened in the first place. So we have our quality and safety team looking into, with the subcontractor, what exactly happened and prevent it from happening again.
Are there any particular challenges that you expect to encounter as we go along that heavily traverse downtown area? You know, it's a main artery. And so I'm not sure if you anticipate any problems in that artery.
Oh, most definitely. I spoke about it a little bit earlier about where we're caught between HDOT and DOH, and they both have very valid concerns. And so we're trying to stay within the means because, yes, if we had our choice, we would shut down them highway in both directions. So we have a huge area to work with. We don't have to worry about pedestrian and traffic access because it makes us less efficient. But obviously, there's no way we're going to shut down Nimitz. That's what we're worried about, is if something unforeseen happens and we do have to extend hours. Because I want to say during the regular work hours, we can shut down, let's say, maybe two lanes, but when peak traffic, we have to put it back to one lane. So just anything unforeseen that happens, we will adversely impact the community in one way or another, and we don't need to frustrate them any more than they already are.
And then can you talk about the work that's going to be underway in Chinatown and how tricky that might be?
Yes. Yeah, so Chinatown, so this contractor is much different than the first two segments. Building the guideway is much more easier. On the west side, it was segmental and methodical and repetitive. So they tackled that first, and then they saved the stations for last. Well, lessons learned. So thankfully, Tudor has learned that watching the other two segments, that becomes the critical path where the guideway is done, but you have all of these stations, and they're very difficult to build. They are starting immediately. So actually, the foundation work for Chinatown Station should start within the next, if not by the end of this month, I want to say within the next couple of months, they're already going to start the work over there. And so they'll concurrently build the stations along with the guideway. We are working very closely with all of the utilities and making sure they are very much aware of the work that we're doing.
Anything else, though, that you want to get out to underscore as you move into the urban core?
We don't have much wiggle room, especially Halekuwila. It's so tight down there.
We've been hearing from Lori Kaikina, a CEO of HEART. That community workshop takes place at the Honolulu Community College cafeteria tonight, starting at 6 p.m. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating nearly 90 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii, with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
As we move into the AI area, how do we prepare our young people to adapt to this change? Mid-Pacific Institute President Paul Turnbull was invited to be part of a panel at last month's NVIDIA conference to address AI literacy. We wondered, are our students our guinea pigs?
I think from the education standpoint, because I was the representative from kindergarten through 12th grade, the biggest thing is just to say that we shouldn't ever look at schools as either not ready because the students are too young to understand something, that's sort of pejorative, you know, you're not old enough yet, or to look at schools as workforce training centers. Neither of those things are true. And so what we talked a lot about was the fact that in education, what we try to talk about are things like desirable difficulties, right? Something that is a complex, multi-layered, multi-step process that we have tried to learn over a period of time. It's really difficult at first. And then as you gain steam and you gain knowledge and mastery of these particular components for that really difficult problem, you break through these barriers and what you end up with is lifelong learning. And that sort of struggle is really important on the education side. In industry, struggle is the thing they're trying to reduce, right? You want to reduce friction as much as possible so there's high productivity and high efficiency, and then that means the bottom line is always like, you know, better profits. But in education, it's the opposite. So the conversation was really about how AI helps to develop that productive struggle, that desirable difficulty, without having students think less. It's a really complex task, but it's exciting.
I worry that the reliance on AI will make us lose that critical thinking skill, you know, to analyze things. And I just worry, even as I scan the internet and I get these AI summaries, something in my gut tells me, oh, this is not quite right. But that's only after some years of living. And then I just worry about our young people as they have these tools before them that they're going to lose some of that muscle in their brain.
There's evidence that shows that AI usage without guidance can definitely go in that direction. And we refer to that as cognitive offloading, meaning you're going to have AI do all the work for you and you're thinking less about the actual issue. However, there's also new research that's just coming out that started to show the opposite, that with guidance, students can offload some of the low-level stuff to AI. So, for example, if you and I were assigned as students together and we had to do a history project, call it on Mesopotamia and how the evolution of the civilization in Mesopotamia ended up helping the broader, you know, society in that era. There are elements of that that are factual things that in the old days you and I would have either looked up in an encyclopedia or we would have gone and Googled it. AI can do all of that low-level stuff for us. What then happens is that we start working on the higher-level critical thinking aspects of pulling together disparate pieces of knowledge, figuring out how they work together in a complex way, and then coming up with our own creative solutions. And so the more we use AI in the right way, the better the students actually do overall. So there's one outcome, an academic outcome. But the way they learn how to integrate knowledge from these different areas into the way they think ends up helping them for life. So you're thinking like a historian, right? And you're thinking like a mathematician, and you're using all of this information that's been given to you because you've trained perhaps a chatbot to go look for these things. But the key is how those students are guided. And that's the most important thing right now, I think, in education, is figuring out a way to have teachers and administrators understand how to use AI, and then how to teach with AI, and then how to have AI treated as a partner rather than just simply a tool the way that we might use a graphing calculator.
Yeah, and I was going to ask, you know, how do you then challenge the teachers to come up with a way, with the guardrails, as we have our children in the classroom every single day using this technology?
At MidPacific, we started really early on this work, and I think that's why I was invited to NVIDIA to speak. So just again, brief history, OpenAI came out with ChatGPT in 2022. MidPacific jumped right on that bandwagon. It was November or the end of October it came out. We were already talking about it in November, just a few weeks later. And part of our AI framework for learning answers that question, Catherine, that you just asked. So our teachers have essentially a continuum that they can work with that allows them to work with the students and allows the students with clarity to understand whether they are or are not using AI for classwork or an assignment or homework. And there are five components from one end of the spectrum to the other. There's AI has no role whatsoever, and the teacher would say that, and so the students understand. Then there's the potential of AI as an idea collaborator. So when I mentioned a partner as an example, then there's AI as an analyst. How can AI help you analyze this information, right? So that you're applying it for a different purpose. Then the last two are AI is an editor to help you. You do the original work, but sometimes we go to other friends and we say, hey, can you take a look at this? Does this make sense? So now you have a partner that doesn't sleep as an editor.
Ah.
And then the last one is AI as a co-creator, a true partner. How can you have this partner beside you who can help you think about certain things, but you are always in control? You are always the one who is saying, here's where I want to go. Here's where my voice resides in this assignment. So that's the continuum. And then all the way through, we also talk about AI literacy. And on campus, that's being knowledgeable about AI, being critical, being ethical, and being aware. So those are really important components. And we work on those things all the time. So it requires constant care and feeding.
You have been a resource as well for a lot of educators in the public schools, where you bring people together to have these deep conversations about this really pivotal time that we're in as we deal with integrating technology in everyday lives.
That's right, yes. On a couple of different levels, actually. Our students have gone to the Schools of the Future conference here locally. So you've got around 2,000 educators, public, private, and charter, who go to the Hawaii Association of Independent Schools and DOE Collaborative Education Conference, one big one every year. Our students have presented years through a number of different AI topics. Then we've got students who have also presented at national conferences. We have students who have, they've helped our teachers right here on campus in sessions. And we've got students who are in national competitions as well. They're remarkable, our kids. I can't sing their praises highly enough. And then we also on campus here host an AI Ed Future Summit. It's a 3-day summit in July. This summer will be our third year. The first day of that 3-day summit is focused on community. So we have as many people in the community, meaning industry, nonprofits, other schools, all come to campus. They share a little bit of what they're using AI for. We work with them to maybe think about different ways to use it, and that's through our staff and our students. The second day is educationally based. So our teachers from other schools, other administrators from other schools, look at how education can specifically work with AI. And then the third day is more introspective, and that's with our AI Advisory Council that Mid-Pacific has hosted for a couple of years. And they help really the leadership on campus here really dig into some new AI topics and really look down the road at what's coming up. The council's outstanding.
Yeah, so it's really reaching out to the community and say, let's go forward together as we try and figure this out.
That's right. We don't believe that the most successful schools will be the highest castle on the highest hill. It's not about resource acquisition and attainment anymore. It's about being a hub and a network. And if we're a hub and a network, then that means that we're working with our friends and our neighbors, and we're helping anybody, frankly, who asks a question. And it's been really successful. We've had a number of, on the nice side, we've got teachers and administrators who have been winning awards because of the great work that they're doing. But really, we're most happy when we see our kids coming together.
Yes, and watching them shine.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to just underscore about your takeaway attending this conference? Because in that universe, what a great opportunity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. First of all, just to be at NVIDIA, essentially the mothership, the global mothership of AI at this point, because of all the chips that they are actively producing and now the ecosystems that they're building within, was amazing. Being around folks who are at the cutting edge of all this, they're on the vanguard of every new thing that seems to be happening in AI, was nothing but short of extraordinary, I would say. And what I walked away with was this understanding that schools are never going to keep up with the pace of real life and certainly the pace of generative artificial intelligence and its development. But what we can do is understand the foundational parameters that will help students become fantastic users and partners with AI as adults. And the more that we surround ourselves with experts and the more that we understand that we are learners ourselves, then the crazy cool tools and technology that come along with that only help us be better supporters of students. And when that happens, then our kids flourish and they thrive and we've done our job tenfold.
We've been hearing from Paul Turnbull, president of Mid-Pacific Institute, which has long had an emphasis on technology and learning. Its advisory council includes members from Microsoft and NVIDIA. We'll have links to Turnbull's talk on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Legacy of Life Hawaii, dedicated to saving and enhancing lives through organ and tissue recovery, recognizing April as National Donate Life Month. Organ donor registration at registerme.org.
An ocean expert is in town tonight with a mission to convince us all that the ocean is really a type of engine. Helen Chersky is a professor of environment and society at the University College London. She's to give a public lecture this evening at the University of Hawaii at Manoa as part of the Better Tomorrow speaker series. The title of her talk refers to her book about the sea. It's called The Blue Machine. Chersky spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about understanding the physics behind our lives and the world.
I'm just interested in how the world works. And I found quite early on as a kid, I was always interested in science and sort of all of the sciences, biology and chemistry and physics. But what I found was that the physical mechanisms, they explain something at a deeper level because they allowed you to predict better. If you understand a mechanism, you can see it in one place, but then you see the same bit of physics in lots of other places. So in a way, you only ever have to learn it once, but then you can, it's like a tool that you bring out a toolbox, you can keep applying it. And so for me, that way of breaking down the world to look for the sort of fundamental, what's physically happening, that was very satisfying. And of course, the brilliant thing about being interested in that is that we live in a physical world. There's things all over the place doing interesting physical things. And so you're basically living in a toy box if you live life like that. And so that's basically become my profession.
Let's give one example of one of those physical concepts that you learn and then it just pops up everywhere.
Oh, so one of my favorites to demonstrate, because everyone, I promise you'll be playing with this next time you see an egg, is the concept. It's got a boring physics name. It's called angular momentum. But if you imagine you've got two eggs and they're in their shells and one of them is raw and one of them is boiled. So basically, they look exactly the same from the outside. But you can tell the difference between them. And what you do is you put them flat on the table on their side and you sort of spin them round. So you get your egg spinning. And after it's been spinning for a bit, you just put your finger on the top of it and take it away. And the two eggs will do two different things. And I'm going to tell you how it works. But once people see it, they tend to work it out for themselves. So basically, when you put your finger on the solid egg, you stop the whole egg. But when you put your finger on the shell of the egg that's raw, it's still liquid inside, the liquid is still spinning around. You stopped the shell, but you did not stop the liquid because the liquid has what's called angular momentum. And that means that once it starts spinning, it will keep spinning. So you stop the shell, but the liquid is still spinning. And so after a while, the whole egg starts to spin again. So that's the raw egg. And so this concept that things will keep spinning in the same way unless you stop the whole thing, that's really important in physics. And there's just one example of somewhere really unexpected where that turns up. That same bit of physics is what keeps the Hubble Space Telescope pointed in the same direction all the time. So of course, the Hubble Space Telescope is out in space. It's taking amazing pictures of galaxies and the rest of the universe. But it's not attached to anything, right? So it has to know where it is in order to point in the right direction. And the way it does it is it's basically got a spinning thing on the inside. It's not an egg, it's a gyroscope, but it's exactly the same principle. It's spinning in one direction, it will stay spinning in that direction. And because the telescope can tell which direction that spin is going in, that gives it something to orient around. So the same bit of physics, this thing you can demonstrate with an egg in your kitchen, is keeping one of the most sophisticated scientific instruments of our time doing the right thing in space. And so if you can go all the way from your kitchen to space, you can cover a lot of things in between.
Whoa. Okay. So from eggs to the Hubble Space Telescope. Your most recent book, though, The Blue Machine, is about the ocean. Let's unpack this analogy, right? The ocean as a type of machine.
So I'm using machine here as a physical entity that's doing things. The point is that when we talk about the ocean, we often talk about the things in it, the ships and the fish and the pollution. And of course, all of that's very important. But the water itself, that's the biggest story on Earth, I think. And the water it's moving around and it's moving like an engine. It gets an input of energy, which is almost all heat energy from the sun. And of course, the Earth is spinning and there's wind pushing on the surface. And so all of these are driving the water into motion. And the brilliant thing about the ocean, and of course, I feel a bit silly saying this in Hawaii. When I say this in London, everyone sort of goes, oh, but here you're surrounded by the ocean. And it's doing different things when you zoom out and look from far away, and when you zoom right in and look from really close too. It's kind of doing different things, but they're all overlapping with each other. So if you zoom all the way out, you can see that the ocean is this huge engine. There's these currents that are moving the water around the whole globe. And if you zoom right in, you can see things like breaking waves and bubbles and the really, really small processes. But this whole thing together, this engine analogy, it isn't really an analogy. It is taking heat energy and turning it into movement, which is what an engine does. And the reason it matters is that the way water behaves completely defines how planet Earth works. And that water is carrying heat, it's carrying nutrients, it's carrying life, it's moving things around. And once you start to look at the structure of our world, you know, the human world and the animal world, you can see things all over the place that are shaped because the ocean did something. So it's not just a kind of random, oh, you happen to have lots of fish over here, or you happen to, you know, have this strange weather pattern over there. Even though we only see the surface of the ocean, the way it turns underneath the surface is affecting all these things up on the top.
Hawaii has a pretty cool set of cameos in The Blue Machine. I mean, what were a few places that reporting for the book took you, of the laboratories you were inside, the research that you got to peer at?
Well, so, of course, one of the most important things for the book is that I was very fortunate over many years to spend time with Kimokeo Kapahuluhua on Maui. And he is a mentor to my paddling club in London. You know, we came and paddled with him, and I learned a lot from his view of the world. And that was the point. Speaking with Kimokeo was very important for me because I had this physical view of the world. I thought about breaking waves and bubbles. That's my academic study. So I came at the physics of it. And then I learned his point of view and the Hawaiian point of view, which is to look at the same thing and see something different. And I think there's something really important in that, because the ocean is not one thing. There's not one way of looking at the ocean. There's all these different ways. It's kind of like looking through lots of different windows at the same thing. So the time I spent here in Hawaii paddling and also doing science has been very important. The first research ship I was ever on was the Kila Moana. So yes, Hawaii has been very important along the way. The experiences of paddling and seeing the ocean through the eyes of others has been really important. And of course, actually, there were three things. I also visited Otek on the Big Island, where they have these two amazing pipes, which are actually colored blue and red, which are bringing hot water and cold water out of the ocean. They're like the faucets, you know, bringing water that's cold and warm and doing all kinds of things with them. But I love that they actually painted the pipes blue and red.
Yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't you? But still, it's brilliant. And so what has been the best thing about writing a book like that and the visits is that you see all these different types of enthusiasm, right? I got to meet a seaweed farmer in Cornwall in England, and it was his job to walk the coast, and he saw things in seaweeds and types of seaweed that I hadn't imagined. And then I got to, you know, visit historical sites. So, for example, in Victorian England, there's a story in there to do with sewers. I promise it's more exciting than it sounds. But there's all these different types of enthusiasm, and together they build up a picture of the ocean. And I think that's the important thing. You know, the ocean is not just one thing, but it just gets better. The more different ways you look at it, the richer it becomes. And in the same way that we wouldn't think a human is just kind of a stick figure, you know, two arms, two legs and a head, we shouldn't think of the ocean as just a pool of water. So yeah, the richness of it is all the fun.
Talking to different people to take different looks at the same thing. It's like, it's almost like you're describing writing a biography of the ocean, and you're interviewing the people who are close to it and who've seen it in various stages and in various places.
Yeah, I have to think about that, because it's a really interesting, it is like that. It is like getting to know a person you can't have a direct conversation with, getting to know an entity you can't have a direct conversation with, but we can understand. And yeah, of course, that's where the science comes in, is that there's a few little, some quite basic things about the ocean that people don't think about very much. Once you see them, you see the whole thing differently. And that, and what that, the reason that matters is that it not only is fascinating, it fulfills curiosity, we get lots of joy out of that, it gives you agency. And that is the most important thing, that it lets you ask the right questions, and it lets you come up with, it lets you decide what to do next. And so having a view of the ocean that lets us all be better decision makers, that's really important, I think.
What's paddling in London like?
Cold. So the reason I started paddling, so I came to Hawaii many years ago and I saw an outrigger canoe on the, it was ridiculously cliched. It was sunset on one of the beaches somewhere, and there were, you know, there were teams training out sort of beyond the surf zone. And I saw that. And then maybe a couple of years later, I was in London and I spoke to someone and they said they paddled outrigger canoes in the Thames, which is clearly cold and grey. And I thought, anybody crazy enough to paddle Hawaiian canoes in London must be good fun. So I went along to this club and they were. And so paddling is very different. I mean, we do not do change races.
No water changes,
right? If we had to do a hooli drill, everybody, you know,
would get
take a deep breath.
Yeah.
So we stay in the canoe. That's very important. But other than that, and of course, then we're mostly in Europe. We have big rivers, so we can paddle along rivers, and the Thames is a big river. So there's a wonderful race, the Great River Race, where every year all these traditional boats of lots of different types go all the way through the centre of London, past all the history. And to do that in an outrigger canoe from the other side of the world, alongside dragon boats from Asia and coracles, tiny little traditional boats from the north of England and from Scotland. It's this wonderful sort of all these creative ways humans have to take to sea. So to paddle an outrigger canoe in that company is a very special thing. But definitely, yes, we do paddle a bit differently, and we definitely stay in the canoe.
While you're in Hawaii, you'll be giving a talk Thursday. What should listeners look forward to?
Oh, stories. I'm a storyteller. So I think one of the interesting things about the ocean, and of course, I am very aware that coming here to Hawaii and telling stories about the ocean is, this is not new to you. You've been doing it for far longer than I have. But I think there are different types of stories that show how the ocean is fitted into different civilizations in the world and different lives. And of course, we've got lots of science about how the ocean has influenced how animals exist. So the talk's going to be stories that illustrate how the ocean works and how the ocean has shaped our world. So I won't tell you all the stories, but it really is, like, I think the fun way to do this is to sort of, you need a logical thread of what you're telling. But really, one example might be cod in the North Sea. And the next example could be a story from ancient Rome about why a battle was won or lost. And the story after that is about why ancient Egypt even had enough water to have an inundation and to build pyramids. And so that's the fun of it, right? That you can tell a big story by sort of these little windows in on all these fun things. So that's what's coming up.
That was University College London Professor Helen Chersky. She gives a talk tonight at 7 p.m. as part of the Manoa Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. We'll have links on our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
You know, this weekend will be a blast from the past. The story of Hawaii jazz saxophonist Gabe Balthazar Jr. will take center stage at Manoa Valley Theater. It's thanks to one of the musicians who got his start at what was then the jazz hotspot in Honolulu, the Cavalier Club. And it's located at the Pan Am Building, which is just across from HPR Studios. And Benny Rettveld, who was the musical director and bassist for the group Santana, was that musician. And just before sitting down in our studios, he swung by the old club to snap a picture of what was.
Gabe was such a mentor to me and like a ton of other local musicians here. And that was part of his thing, because his dad also mentored him, you know, and he wanted to pass that on, and he was really good about that. In fact, after the Stan Kenton thing, that's why he came back here, to share what he learned out there in the world. And there were jazz clubs before, but as soon as we hit the Cavalier, it became this kind of a mainstream thing, and it was packed every night practically. And the weird thing was, it was six nights a week, which was really unheard of. People were like, you can't play jazz anywhere in the world six nights a week. But in Hawaii at that time, you could. And then there was like a ton of other venues. There was Trappers and Keone's, you know, Marrakesh, the place in Kahala, the Wharf, I think, Spindrifter, you know, Kojak's, you know, there was a lot.
It was happening.
It was really crazy. And it wasn't even like it was all like DJ stuff or disco or anything. It was all like jazz or spinoffs of jazz. It was like, you know, Brazilian, you know, like Sandy, everyone.
Sandy Sugiyama, yeah. Yes. No, I was lamenting that we have fewer venues now than we did before. And, you know, your play and your story that you're bringing up on stage is a snapshot in our music history.
It's a little homage, you know, because it was such a unique time, unique place, you know, unique era. I mean, the middle of the Pacific Ocean, there's this jazz hotbed, you know. I learned so much that I still use to this day. And musicians learned a lot, you know, from Gabe. And people who weren't musicians were enriched in ways that they wouldn't have had been able to be enriched by in any other time, you know. It brought joy and fun to everyone's lives, you know. That's what live music does anyway, not just jazz. But it was a very interesting time. And, you know, so it's like a tribute to that. Tribute to the place, the man, Gabe Balthazar, and the era, the supporters of radio, one of the foremost radio DJs from that time, Heidi Cheng, she's going to be there. You know, there was amazing synergy of creativity.
Yeah. Well, you know, what was it like for you putting this story together on stage? Because I understand you're going to have a few musicians, actually.
Yeah, actually not as many as I normally have. Most of my shows when I do the Manoa Valley Theater, they're like 20 musicians, 50 singers, you know, all this stuff. This is like a very much more intimate thing. These are the original guys that played at the Cavalier. Doug McDonald on guitar, Carl Wakeland on piano, Noel Okimoto, like, who's a local stalwart, Hana Hana Award winner on drums. Sandy is going to be here. You know, she used to be back in the day, too. That she hung out. She sat in with us. Rachel Gonzalez was also a local, amazing jazz singer that I knew at UH, you know. Amazing classical singer, too. Heidi, Scott Villager, who's going to be the bass clarinet player, because Gabe played every horn. So Alan, the other guy that I played with in high school, said, you know, I'm not going to play all these horns. You got to get Scott. So Scott would be playing. Alan Wan, of course, my bandmate from McKinley High School, along with Noel. And then we had our own band called Topaz back in the day with Carl. So it's all like it was very easy to put together, you know. Yeah.
It just sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, you know, it's a throwback to that time. It's Gabe's story. It's your story. Mm-hmm.
It's not really my story. I mean, to me, the story is Gabe and that time and place in Hawaii, you know. I was just a part of it, and I was green, I had a propeller cap on, you know. So I was just learning. Yeah, it's really about the time and place and that guy, Gabe, that, you know, spearheaded, even unknowingly, this whole jazz renaissance in Hawaii, you know.
Well, and the fact, though, that you have gone on to play on some incredible stages with some incredible musicians and are still doing it today, you know. I don't know, what advice would you give to, you know, young musicians out there who just love jazz, who just love to play music?
I mean, do it if you love it, you know, and just be prepared to do a lot of hard work. And that's regardless. I mean, not always 70s. 80s till now, you know, I know there's a lot of tools that people use that can supposedly make music easier, better, whatever, or, you know, like they think social media is like the be all end all to everything. But those things always have their cycle. At the end of the day, it's the people that put in the most work will still come up with something different than, you know, because if you can make something or make a flyer or make a song with a few pushes of a button, then that means about a million other people can do that too. Mm-hmm. So it's still hard work to just try and rise above that noise, which always was the case, but now it's different tools, you know.
Well, you know, when I look around at the musicscape and you look at some of these classic tunes and these musicians, and not just jazz, you look at what they produce when they were so young. You know, and they've just become classics. And that's just so exciting to see up-and-coming musicians just killing it.
Yeah. And that's part of the cycle of the show, because Gabe was helping all these young people, me, Carl, Noel, Doug, and everyone who would come up and sit in. He would just mentor everybody, and we'd learn, like, so much. I learned stuff that I still use to this day back then. I mean, it was... like, even a lot of schools today can't give anybody that kind of... We were there sweating it out, playing bebop 6 nights a week, you know.
Grind, yep.
And, you know, I really had to learn. This stuff is so ingrained in my muscle memory and my genes. It's amazing. So, yeah, to this day, yeah.
As you think back just on your time in music and the people that influenced you.
Yeah, Gabe. My mentors were... Henry Miyamura from McKinley High School, and then Miles, and then Carlos. You know, like, it's immeasurable how much influence and really training about how to approach music. Not so much stylistically, but the inner game of music. You know, that whole thing. It doesn't matter what genre.
Yeah, improvising.
Yeah, well, not just improvising, but playing it, the commitment you have to have in doing anything, just playing it simple. But yeah, it's really hard. You can't even codify it, really.
Well, do you have any, I don't know, fond memory that you have of the Cavalier Club?
Plenty. I mean, you know, like so many nights. And we had some really great regular fans that would be like Auntie Jean. Oh, yeah, she always brought this great banana bread. It was like amazing. Yeah, we had a guy who called himself Mud. And it was just a great assortment of, you know, people that, all kinds of people. We had a belly dancer. I mean, it was crazy. But they were united in that they were drawn by this commitment to playing to excellence, you know, really. What, you know, we have to be playing jazz. But it was like a bunch of young guys led by an older guy who knew more about the ropes and everything. And that kind of thing, that's a kind of an energy that is palpable. And that's why people kept coming. It was like this, yeah, it's like any other performing art. It's an energy exchange. And then when you have such a great talent leading a bunch of guys that were, had a lot of potential, like Noel. Well, Noel is already like really good, so as a jazz drummer. But you know, Carl, and he was also insanely talented. And Doug, when you have that and a really experienced guy who is really giving, leading the way, that's a great recipe for success.
I don't know. Do you think there's any place like that now for young musicians?
There is a movement that I see. There are people that are trying to do that, and that's, you know, a good sign, but they have to make a living. They have to stay open. They have to keep their doors open. So if everyone could pitch in, if venue owners, smaller ones, and artists alike do their part, then stuff could come back. I mean, I play in L.A. at the Baked Potato all the time. That place is another unique place. It's L.A.'s oldest jazz club. It's a family-owned. It's independent. It's not part of any conglomerate or anything. Completely family-owned. Everyone's very pro-music. And it's been running for 53 years there, playing jazz, blues. And it's the only club I play there because the vibe is so great. And people go there because they know practically any night there's going to be something cool, you know. But as far as for young musicians to work out like that,
it's tougher for them now.
Yeah, it's going to have to be like a mentorship kind of thing. Yeah, it was right place, right time thing.
Well, I think the folks that may remember the Cavalier Club will then be in for a treat this weekend. They flash back.
Oh, it's gonna be cool. Yeah, I'm gonna be flashing back. You know.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was musician Benny Retbel. To find out more about the production of A Night at the Cavalier Club at the Manoa Valley Theater on Friday and Saturday, look for links on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we survey the insurance landscape. Got a story about insurance with the recent flooding disaster? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.